I think today's provided a tremendous insight into an episode of contemporary British and Irish history that's often been misunderstood and is still keenly debated, as we saw earlier. We've been extremely fortunate to have illustrious speakers, as well as illustrious audience members, I'm sure you've noticed. I think there's a sense that a hidden history of the Troubles has yet to be written, and this is a history of the ordinary people doing ordinary things while extraordinary things unfolded around them. The civic voices, the schoolboy and schoolgirl diarists, the housewife, the bin man, the man in the street, the pub bard, and in the case of this panel, Henry Sinnerton, the schoolteacher, who had witnessed and worked at Orangefield Boys Secondary School under the optimistic flourish which the great John Malone brought to education and society in Northern Ireland before it raced headlong into conflict. Undeterred and against colossal odds, it was men and women such as Henry, and also Barbara, who we heard from in the previous panel, the educators, who worked themselves to the bone to produce a small semblance of normality for children who were often forced to be old before their time. And in 1974, Jackie Redpath was an aspiring community worker, originally from the Woodvale district in the Upper Shankill, who, so deeply concerned was he by the effects of violence, deindustrialisation, and crucially the ill-judged redevelopment of the Shankill, decided to get involved and make a difference by saving the Shankill. While we hear today about a rebellion against the British government, Jackie was involved in a people's revolution. That the Shankill is still a community that's in existence today is testimony to the social consciousness and radicalism that can exist within the Protestant working class. And 1974 was, of course, a crucial year for Nell McCafferty, whose new style of campaigning journalism brought to the fore coverage of legal and women's issues in Ireland. A long-time commentator in Northern Ireland, even by that point, her experience of Bloody Sunday and her important book, Peggy Dairy, and an unerring contribution to a comprehension of politics and society, has marked her out as one of the greatest journalists and writers in this island, and an acute observer of the ordinary person experiencing the out of the ordinary. I'm confident that the contributors to this panel will shine a light on this most tumultuous of eras with a candour and eye for the acute detail that brought her narratives and neglected. So I'd like to pass over to Henry now to start the proceedings.
Thank you. My abiding memory is of absolute determination to go to work. No one was going to stop me getting to my place of work, despite threats and menace quite clearly in the air at that time, which could fall upon not just others, but myself as well. To understand why I chose that position on that day, let me sketch for you a few details of my hinterland. I was a working class kid who passed the quali and went to grammar school, Grosvenor, along Roden Street in West Belfast. In 1956, I spent the long school holiday in summer sitting near the bandstand in Woodvale Park reading The Bridget Andow, a book by James Michener, who wrote the stories upon which South Pacific, the Hollywood musical, was based. This book recounted stories of those Hungarian refugees who fled their country in tumult under the Soviet fascist fist. 1956 was also the year of the Suez invasion, when Egyptians were told by the UK and France that their freedom was dependent upon foreign permission. Move forward to 1960, and the Sharpeville massacre happened in South Africa, which served to highlight even more injustice in that country. At that time, too, a young American senator, a Catholic, was running for the presidency of his country, where he would be the first of his denomination to bear that office were he to win. I followed JFK's campaign avidly. Reports in the media about the civil rights movement in the States also informed us of wrongs being unjustly inflicted upon people. In 1963, we heard Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and Kennedy was assassinated later that year. I was brought up on the Springfield Road and Workman Avenue up in West Belfast. Let me give you an idea in Northern Ireland terms of the place where I was reared. Opposite lived the Lettys. Dan was an accountant, only person in the street to have a car and a telephone. Opposite, two doors down, were the Dillies, who ran a pub in the Lower Falls, but they were old and their daughters grown up. Further down in that side lived the McCormicks. Father was a sergeant in the RUC. Son Michael, better known as Mick, became head of PE in St Malachy's. Beside them was the McCullen's house. Almost at the road lived the Shanahans, three boys, Terry, George and Godfrey. But the youngest and prettiest was Louise. Godfrey was a particular hero of mine when I was a wee boy because he played for the Distillery. At the end of our terrace of houses lived a French family. Maureen, who went to Rathmore, was of my age, and Bugle, their dog, their slow Dulux dog, seemed to be at least 100 years old. In our gang, I must include the Currans, Ian Allison, Tom and Jared McKenna from 4th Parade, John Caffrey from Woodville Avenue and a pupil at St. Monachy's, and Freddie Johnson from Cuan Parade up behind us. Our four streets formed a square, and we all played together as chums and pals. We went to six different places of worship on a Sunday. The Methodist round the corner, Drew Memorial down the Grosvenor Road, Clonard Chapel in the Falls, St. Matthew's over in the Shankill, Woodville Presbyterian on the Woodville Road, and our family walked a Broadway Presbyterian past the inviting aroma of Barney Hughes' bakery every Sunday morning. We left and came at different times, and nobody batted an eyelid. An annual part of Yuletide festivities for Jim Nicholson, who lived beside the Lettys and opposite us, and Roy McCurley at the end of the street, was to be taken by their daughter Rosaline Letty down to Clonard to see the Christmas crib. We admired and respected our neighbours. Our parents would accept no less. And we all did unto others as we wished, and so on. That was how we lived in the 40s, 50s and 60s. Thought nothing of it. It was normal for all of us. I proceeded through grammar school. My parents determined neither I or my brother should work in Mackey's, which overshadowed our street and threw its soot on my mother's washing every Monday morning. And they made sacrifices. Well, my brother and I, we had a ball on so many fronts that we chose with great mates. Inevitably, we were processed through the exam system, arrived here at Queen's in a brilliant era, with a literific on a Tuesday night, so affably and humorously chaired by John Murda. We were highly impressed too by Ian McCann. I chose the degree I wanted to work for, spent a year in France and Strasbourg, and came back and wasted a year doing a dip ed under the tutelage of Professor Knox, an awful man, and then went to teach in Orangefield Boys Secondary School in East Belfast. It was a great school, led by a great man with foresight and wisdom. And as David Irvine said of we young teachers, they weren't real. What he meant was we did not follow in the well-worn traditional paths of the teaching profession, but were encouraged to innovate, as John Malone did in the public exam field as one example. For before he took action, public examinations for secondary school pupils were non-existent in Northern Ireland. It was deemed they weren't worthy of a public examination. Malone encouraged us to use initiative, always with focus on progress for the boys as our objective. This, for us young guys, was a better life than being a student, and we got paid. I also made sure I joined a trade union. I had experienced enough hard jobs and suffered bosses who exploited in canning factories in England, in hotels in Scotland and here when I was a student, for I believed trade unions were a means of improving working conditions and contributing to the betterment of society, which my union did. Which my union did, though sadly, some trade union general secretaries behaved like medieval barons. For example, Frank Cousins, who called London Transport to a standstill with a click of his fingers, or Hughie Scanlon, who paralysed industry in Britain on a whim. My union did go on strike over conditions. To get our pay, all teachers had to go down, this is incredible, we had to go down to Academy Street to pick up our chit, which lay on a table in the hallway for all the public to see or open and read. We did strike after debate and argument amongst ourselves in school and at general meetings where we took a vote in the matter, and all this was before Maggie Thatcher. I was nominally shop steward, really wasn't it an onerous job, 20 or 30 other guys could have done it as well or better, and I led the staff out, cheered to the echo by throngs of our pupils. By this time I had voted in my first Westminster election in West Belfast and voted for Jerry Fitt rather than some unionist solicitor donkey, as Gusty Spence would have called him. With other colleagues at Orangefield, I canvassed for one of our staff who stood for the Old Northern Ireland Labour Party in a Stormont election. I remember meeting a dentist from East Belfast on holiday in France. He told me a lot of Orangefield teachers were among his patients, and every tooth he pulled from them was pink. Then, just cause of 1969, nourished on cheerful optimism, soon crumpled when confronted by our old Stark divisions. And our 25-year-old war started, fueled by hate, 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 and more supplies of hate piled upon hate. We had a lease on the deepest hate mine on earth, and we excavated it in industrial proportions. How on earth did we survive the early 70s? It was a ghastly time for us all. Teaching in schools suffered along with the rest of the community, though we were termed oases of peace. Thank God no atrocity was visited upon a school, though that dread lingered over the years at the back of our minds. In my biography of David Irvine, I dealt with the effect within schools of civic disruption outside in the streets. In local secondary schools, teachers began to notice that some normally reliable senior pupils were not returning homework on time, or not doing it at all. Others appeared unusually lethargic in class. Individuals were sore and awkward of movement. Staff were unaware that many pupils were being drilled by the paramilitaries in the street during the night and being punished for misdemeanours of regimental indiscipline by being made to lean on their outstretched arms against the wall for prolonged periods. It was a very rough time to be in East Belfast. Even the primary school children were infected by the atmosphere of violence, sometimes marching along the school corridors in imitation of the illegal paramilitary UDA soldiers whom they had seen in the streets. The older adolescent brothers of these youngsters formed themselves into tartan gangs based on their neighbourhood territory, such as the Newton tartan, the Woodstock tartan, and so on. Now, this is where I disagree about the Bay Street Rollers, okay, and their influence. The term tartan, a word associated with Scotland, accentuated their repudiation of all things Irish and reinforced religious links with the sectarian division in Glasgow, a connection they revered. These tartan gangs were unruly and unpredictable, roaming the streets looking for trouble, specifically with anything or anybody Catholic. In local secondary schools, even those schools which normally would have permitted a certain attitude and dress, principals had to insist that strict school uniform be worn, because each tartan would try to incorporate its own slight variation to a school uniform. For example, the school tie would be worn in a particular knot, or shirt cuffs turned out in a certain fashion, or the jacket collar bent up, all to territorialise a form of dress that was intended to be common garb. School authorities were compelled to take preventative action to avoid gang warfare breaking out in their corridors and to preserve the neutrality of the school environment. So many young lives were affected in the early 70s, far too often destroyed. As a teacher in Orangefield, I witnessed too many young impressionable lads led astray, misled by the bile and hate spewed by Paisley and William Craig and his ilk of Vanguard at their frightening Nuremberg rallies in Botanic Gardens. Young guys, working class for the most part, expendable in the unionist cause. Now, that was their station in the political scheme of things, while their betters went home and watched on TV the resulting mayhem these dupes and dopes went out of their way to create for my Catholic neighbours and fellow citizens. And thus, having experienced all that, in May 1974, I am ordered to stay away from my place of work. But I have no betters. Workman Avenue, the Springfield Road, Broadway, Grosvenor, above all my parents lived this with me. I have equals. Here were fascists coercing me. In the end, it was no big deal. Simple, really. Either I lived up to the way I was brought up or caved in. Self-respect in the gutter. And the decision made itself. And so on that morning of Monday the 20th of May 1974, I walked out over our doorstep just after 8 o'clock, leaving at my normal time, absolutely determined, determined absolutely to go to my work. And I did what I usually do to control my nerves when faced by tension or apprehension or feeling insecure. I kidded myself I would know the outcome by 10 o'clock or tomorrow, and this dreadful situation would be over, perhaps cleared up. I drove down Dunmurry Lane and picked up Roland Davids, our art teacher, as usual at Gracetown Avenue, top of Malone. No problem. Road is free. Over Shaw's Bridge, along the dual carriageway, past Superman. This is great. Nothing's going to happen. Through the lights at the junction with the Craigie, we're sailing by this time, up the hill and down with the Castlereagh traffic lights in sight. Bang. That was when the carriageway sunk in a trice. In the distance, under a mass of men rushing out of the Clonduff estate on the left ahead, swarming over the right of way, stopping all traffic, turning drivers out of their cars and blocking the road. Naive hope was torpedoed. I felt heavy with dread now. Swiftly I turned left off the dual carriageway into a leafy street, quiet and deserted, to park my car in a safe place. And there was no going back. This was the challenge that was lurking all along. Sooner or later it had to happen. And I would go as far as I could physically go to Orangefield Boys' School. We gathered our things from my car and set off. Fortunately, we met three colleagues round a corner who was as determined as Rowley and I. But there was none of the usual banter between mates or friends. This was grim, and we knew it. But all agreed we were going to our work unless... Well, really, we hadn't given any thought to consequences. It was a shock to see a huge barrier blocking the whole way across the Castlereagh Road, except for a gap in the extreme right of the pavement, which allowed one person to pass through. This barrier was massive. You could not see over it nor through it. It was frightening how the atmosphere had changed from almost normality to a feeling of danger. We should have known Belfast couldn't keep up this crippling nervousness. Our side of the barrier was deserted as we five crossed over to go through the narrow passage. And from the other side we heard, "What'll I do with this van, Sergeant?" "Move it, Corporal." "Where will I move it to, Sergeant?" "Just, Corporal." "We'll move it over the road, Sergeant." "Well, just do what you, Corporal." "Would it be better if I left it here, Sergeant?" "No, Corporal, drive it away." "Right, Sergeant, where to?" "Up towards the green, Corporal." "And will I leave it there, Sergeant?" "Well, no, that depends, Corporal." "No orders then, Sergeant." "Oh, for fuck's sake, Geordie, move the fucking van." Even such bizarre comedy could not crack the tense atmosphere. We did not laugh as we passed the hooded sergeant and the masked corporal, for fear Lauren and Hardy might revert to resentful thugs. Anyway, we were too uptight to appreciate such military levity. We got through and arrived at our workplace to learn a colleague had not been as fortunate. He was one of the drivers I saw turned out of their cars by the Clonduff mob earlier. I went into the gents and washed my face. For the first time in my life, I knew what it was like to be in a cold sweat. I looked in the mirror and saw this ashen face. It really was one hell of a scurry escapade. Our colleagues arrived as best they could. Two came by train from Bangor and walked in from Sydenham Station. One drove up through Orangefield Park, the ranger chasing after him furiously because he could not get past another barricade and let us drive. Many walked in. Others drifted in all morning, but few pupils were about. And that set the tone for the rest of the week. No classes as such. Those pupils who did turn up were kept together in the central hall while we got on with administrative tasks or planning. The exam season was on us and we had preparations to make. And that was how each day passed, though as the week went on, more and more pupils arrived back in, chased back into school by the UDA because they were a nuisance in the street for the paramilitaries. We went home and came back and the next day for the rest of the week. At home, like the rest of the community, we had to cope as best we could manage, with all the deprivation served upon us by our paramilitary brethren. Living in Dunmurray, I drove round surrounding farms for milk and eggs. With no electricity, we heated our one-year-old daughter's bottle on an open fire. But everybody was in the same boat. No need for me to recount in detail my deprivations when yours were just as severe. Orangefield Boys' School experience reflected similar upset in all schools. We were no different. No thought was given by the politicians or paramilitarists as to how pupils would be affected in their exam season. I suspect they did not know. If they knew, I doubt they cared. I suspect, too, if the young boys had not caused trouble for them in the streets, then exams for a whole year group might have passed them by. This was a real threat, which loomed larger as each day limped past. The Belfast Telegraph headline on the Monday screamed, "Many city schools forced to close." Things were chaotic after UWC called for all schools to close. A BLB statement said, quote, "Because of low attendance, secondary schools had mostly closed. Those reports were that in some areas, South and East Belfast schools did manage to operate fairly normally." The next day, the Irish News reported CSE exams due to be held that day and Wednesday the 22nd, were postponed until early June. The Department of Education called for cooperation to facilitate attendance, but it was a matter for individuals in light of circumstances near. In other words, they were washing their hands. By Thursday the 23rd, circumstances had deteriorated to such an extent that the Belfast Telegraph and Irish News reported GCE practicals in science were postponed to early June. So dire was the situation, plans were being drawn up for teachers' assessments to replace those examinations. Friday 24th, education authorities seemed in a state of desperation. The department, according to the Belfast Telegraph, this is a joke, advised those teachers who have difficulty getting to their own school because of transport problems, they should present themselves to their nearest school. It's true. While in the Irish News, the department, in an appeal to teachers, was anxious schools should continue to operate as normally as possible. But also on that day, the newsletter appeared, and it was the only time the newsletter reported schools in the whole week, the newsletter appearing to be more in touch with the improving reality, which we knew in Orangefield was changing rapidly for the better, printed a statement from Mr. Basil McIver, Minister of Education, that the use of teacher assessments of students whose A-levels were being hampered by the strike was being reviewed. In other words, things were going to get better. By the following Monday, we knew the crisis in schools was over and could get on with our real work. And that was the UWC strike for us as teachers, and most teachers at the time. So what to make of it all? I offer no grandiose insights, draw no earth-shattering conclusions, except to stress many of us went to our place of work undeterred by intimidation, perhaps through foolishness, I don't know, but we went, and buoyed by like-minded people. Certainly this was no Selma to Montgomery March in 1965, nor Ned Blanke's segregation in South Africa. We simply exercised our right as free citizens in a democratic society to respond civically to pressure from illegal forces, fascism. Perhaps some of our pupils learned that lesson as they returned to school past the bandstand in the park nearby.
Thank you very much, Henry. Jackie, are you okay to go next?
I'm not sure. Oh, yes, I'm good to go, Gareth. Thank you very much. I'm getting heckled from the side and having to say anything. That's all right. No, I'll go first.
Is this a bus? Yeah. The bus to where?
Yeah, that's my business.
Okay.
my apologies for my state address this afternoon, which is different from this morning. But I do have miles to go before I sleep and have promises to keep. So I got caught that one by Henry Sinnerton in Orangefield. It is a wee bit the day like going back to beginnings, because I was one of the people cheered him when he went out and strike on Orangefield, the strike he was on, evidently, which was before 1974. And it was an amazing school and a wonderful school led by a brilliant school principal who wasn't simply ahead of his time but was a one-off, and also by brilliant staff. And like Henry, I travelled across town to that school because I failed the 11 plus, and the class I was going to be put into in the boys' model was sort of more or less what used to be called an ESN class, or educationally subnormal. Somehow or other I managed to do an IQ test in Orangefield, in which I did all right and got put into a grammar stream. And anyway, I travelled across town to Orangefield. And it is like a bit like beginnings here, because I don't know who I had to leave during the afternoon, but certainly this morning's crowd and that were contributing, and Henry, I'm by far the youngest, and I feel a wee bit fraudulent because I was a bit young when the UWC strike was actually on, but I'll tell you about that in a wee second. But also, a thing about beginnings is walking in here, I had the luck in going to Orangefield that after a couple of years of struggling very badly, I started to find my feet a wee bit due to a lot of the good teachers, and ended up in Queens here, and this is the first time back in this room, which was my history lecture room when I came here.
Very happy return.
Used to sit up at the back, and it's been quite amazing coming back in. There's a few marks up there, names.
Did you make those?
Trying to say, no, mine wasn't on it, but
didn't throw anything.
I didn't actually hang about Queen's too long. I never really became part of it because there was too much happening back in the Shankill. For me, what was happening was a thing called the Jesus Liberation Front, but that's another story. One of the good things about it was it kept me out of a bit of trouble. If getting into trouble was joining a paramilitary organisation, it kept me out of that in my formative years. And therefore, when I got to 1974, having left the Jesus Liberation Front, I hadn't joined any other Liberation Front either, and really wasn't much of a joiner, and certainly not in terms of any sort of apprenticeship. But the apprenticeship that I had, which was 5 months old in May 1974, was as a community worker. In February that year, I started my first job as a community worker in the Shankill for the Shankill Community Council. And people were talking about the power sharing executive today and stuff, and it was interesting that Morris Hayes here. One of the amazing things that was established before the power sharing executive in 1974 was the, under the Ministry of Community Relations, was a thing called the Community Relations Commission, not Council, Commission. And it was headed up by a chairman called Morris Hayes. I think he was chairman, and had a director called Hugh Griffiths. And it had a batch of field workers, field officers, who I think ostensibly were supposed to go out doing community relations work, as in getting Protestants and Catholics that were not liking each other to work better together and like each other a bit. But in fact, it adopted a totally different approach. And for the first time in Northern Ireland, it adopted an approach about community development, whereby these field officers went into areas of West Belfast, North Belfast, and in towns throughout the province to do community development work. And it was a very radical organisation in its time. And at that time, the Shankill, as it always was stuck in terms of some sort of crisis of identity. Was it in West Belfast? Was it in North Belfast? One part of it was West, one part of it was North. So there was a community relations officer for West, community relations commission officer for West, and one for North, and none that was really operating on the Shankill. And as a result of that, the first independent community development officer was appointed to an organisation in the Shankill Community Council, and that was me in February 1974. I mention that because it's relevant in that one of the first acts that the power sharing executive did when it came into power, and the Minister of Community Relations, who was Ivan Cooper, was to abolish the Community Relations Commission. Not because it was doing community relations work, but because it was doing community development work. And I can only assume that that work, which a lot of which was happening in nationalist areas, was seen as a threat to the SDLP at that point. And it was very, very sad that that organisation was axed as one of the first things that the power sharing executive did in 1974. As I say, it was all new to me. I was honestly doing an apprenticeship as a 23-year-old community worker. I wouldn't have given myself the job. I wouldn't. I definitely wouldn't. And I was looking at what was going on, but I couldn't miss what was going on. And I think what people need to know is this here. I don't see the Ulster Workers' Council strike as an event. I actually see it as a work in progress. It is something which is still being worked out in society today, what was happening then. Mm-hmm. And I think Lenny Barr described it well this morning when he described what can only be what certainly at the time was felt as massive and not exaggerating, call them cataclysmic events on the streets. I mean, from a Protestant working class point of view, from a Protestant community point of view, and a unionist and loyalist point of view, what was happening was the very quick stripping away of almost everything that you had known as certainty. Now, here I'm not here to defend or make a judgment on anything about 50 years of misrule or not or whatever. That's not this occasion today. What I am here to bear testament to was that as a community, and particularly as a working class community in somewhere like the Shankill and other parts, It felt like everything you had known was now up for grabs, and that everything you had known was being stripped away. And it brought, it stirred up that old sense, which was hundreds of years old, of being a community under siege. And what had happened was that the government was gone a couple of years before that. That was what people had known. What had happened was that there was an armed campaign on the streets that was gathering intensity at the point where, as Glenn Barr pointed out in March that year, I think he quoted 921 security incidents in that month, the most in that year, that was extremely intense. And it was a time when your very identity was under question. There were no more certainties. It was as though things were being lost on every side and on every front, and not least economically, where for those that were aware of it, the shipyard was going. It wasn't just slipping away, it was going quite quickly. Where the linen industry, the last mills, were closing, 18 of which had surrounded 1 square mile around the Shankill, the last of them were closing down. Where Mackey's was, the engineering works was in very dramatic decline in terms of its workforce. All those things were happening. The politics was gone. The RUC had been disarmed. The B specials had been stood down. The economy that people had known was in its last legs. And as well as that, there was the massive process of redevelopment, with a population in the Shankill of 76,000 people in free fall to what would become 23,000 people, over 50,000 people in a 10-15 year period bulldozed out of that area and of other areas like it. Now, I'm not talking about that. That happened in the docks in Belfast, which was not a loyalist area. It was wiped out completely. I'm not talking about that as something that was happening to a Protestant community alone. But what I am doing is putting together a picture here, I think, that Professor Mike Morrissey has called, in terms of the Shankill being hit by the perfect storm. The economic collapse, the political collapse, the redevelopment, the impact of redevelopment, societal changes that were happening, all happening over a very short period of years, 2-3 years, we're talking about all this happening, led to the fact that at this point in May 1974, there was something combustible there that was going to happen. There was a community trying to come to terms with deep and dramatic change, which was not of its making, and which was being forced upon it. That's without moral judgment. I'm simply saying that change was happening, and happening from outside, and it was a community, therefore, that responded in many ways in the only way it knew how, and that was to fight back. And I think it's important just to understand that I started the job with that sort of scene around me. The biggest thing in my face was not the collapse of the politics, was not the economic decline. The biggest thing in my face was the housing and the redevelopment that was happening. And looking back now at photos that were taken at the time by Buzz Logan and by others, it is almost impossible to imagine the chaos of living through that redevelopment alone, never mind all the other factors that were at work. My very first meeting with the planners was in March that year, and I went up to Shaftesbury Square to a place called Carton House, which eventually was to become a brew, and met a guy called Harding MacDonald, who was then housing executive, having taken over from the corporation, who had plans laid out in front of him for the Shankill. And it was that wee bit down below Shankill, behind Shankill Leisure Centre, Percy Street and Wigton Street, and those streets that he had laid out a new plan for. The old terraced houses were gone, and there he had 9 blocks of flats. I was with a guy called Ron Wiener, who wrote the book, the seminal book, The Rape and Plunder of the Shankill, another girl called Claire Curry, who's a youth worker in the Shankill YMCA. And we went, it was my first meeting of anything like this, didn't even have anything to say. They said, I wouldn't have given me a job. And I said, and we argued against these 9 blocks, there was arguments put up against these 9 blocks of flats going up. And Harding MacDonald sat and said, look, he says, you see, when the people came to live here 100 years ago, they came in from the countryside, they weren't used to the terrace houses, they got used to them, they'll get used to these flats. And I got out of my office. And I got out of that office today and swore that I would never go back to meet these people in that situation again unless I had something behind me. And that something became something that I learned out of the UWC strike, because it was a seismic event and it was a seminal event, and it was for me. Because I was only a couple of months into the job. I'd been up to Stormont to meet Austin Currie, who was Minister of Housing, who was here this morning. Due to redevelopment, there was a small group of us went up to meet him to try and get something done about the housing situation. I was living in the Hammer, down at the bottom of the Shankill at the time, wasn't long married, and I remember going out one night to my front door and hear people talking about it, talking outside the front door, and listening in, since I was inside, I was entitled to. I discovered they were trying to find out who the fuck had gone up to meet this Fenian bastard at Stormont. I didn't open the door, kept it shut. And that was just a month before the UWC strike happened. So I was brand new to this, not knowing very much, but I watched the strike. I actually don't remember very much about it. I remember bulletins going out like this from the Orange Volunteers, bulletin number one getting placed up in the wall, and you went out to read what was happening, and then commercial bulletin going up in the wall, and then something about nominated garages, and not that I had a car, I had no great interest in what garage was open or not, but these things sort of passed me by, except these bulletins struck me as a great idea, and a few years later we started producing the Shankill Bulletin in this wee form that became this as well, and we called it the Bulletin, deliberately coming from those bulletins that had been put up. That was one small thing I noticed and learned from those days of the strike. But there was a much bigger thing that I learned, and that was that if we were going to take this issue of redevelopment on, because after these seismic events like strikes, and after all seismic events, whether they're feuds or strikes or flag protests, people have to come back to living. People have to come back to dealing with life as it is in front of them. And I felt during all those years that one of the roles in the community is to make sure that there's something, to keep something alive for people to come back to. And the big issue that was still there after the strike was over, because what I want to just mention, and I'll not be long now, what I want to mention is that the impact of this strike down the generations. Glennie talked this morning about his meeting when he was in Canada with some of the people of the First Nation that talked about when they're making decisions, they think of seven generations down the line. That's a good, good thing for us to learn about. And I think that strike has had a resonance down the years. There's a way in which it was the last vicious kick of the old working class, and it's a bit of muscle, industrial muscle. And there's a way in which it was that. There's a way in which it was an end of that, and there was a way in which it was a new beginning. Coming out of it, I hoped for new politics. I looked to people like Glenn Barr and thought, that's the future. It wasn't actually to come to full fruition, that. But what I did learn was that what made that I was never going back to those planners. I was never going back to those planners empty-handed and to be told that this was what they were going to do and not have an answer for it. In October 1974, we formed the Save the Shankill campaign. And in the run-up to forming the Save the Shankill campaign, after years of destruction and redevelopment, in the run-up to it, we were looking to see how we'd put it together. And we turned to the organisers of the UWC strike. We went to the Ulster Workers' Council and we asked them to nominate someone who had been on the front line of the strike on the actual organising committee, and also on the second tier of the strike, the people that Glenn talked about in case they were scooped that would take over. And we got two local people onto the Save the Shankill campaign, one to chair it. We went to the UDA and we said to the UDA, the fight that you've been fighting is one fight and it's your business. There's another struggle here for the future of this community. It's a struggle about redevelopment. It's a struggle about what we call the other war that is being fought. The UDA, the UVF, the Orange Volunteers, Women's Action, some of you might remember, the UWC, local community groups, the Shankill Traders Association, the local churches, and the local political parties, come back to that in a second, all became part of the Save the Shankill campaign and got named on the very first poster that we put up in October 1973 or 74. And by February 1975, we had begun to turn the Housing Executive's plans for the redevelopment of the Shankill on their heads, and within 5 months had achieved that no more flats would be built on the Shankill, that the Ribbon Shopping would not be demolished, apart from what they had already demolished, and that houses would begin to be rehabilitated in the what was then called the Upper Shankill. Now, it was a long struggle after that. But what I want to say is that what I learned from the UWC strike was, number one, that the organisations involved, the Ulster Workers' Council, were ordinary men, lots of whom, and most of the leadership, were shop stewards, who in ordinary times would have been going about their shop steward business. That the paramilitaries in the Shankill be a killing machine, yep, but were my next door neighbours whose houses were being knocked down. And that by bringing a coalition of them and community organisations and churches and the local shopkeepers and the political parties, interestingly, another lesson learned from the UWC strike, without any politicians, Save the Shankill campaign never had a politician on its committee. It had representatives of constituency associations on it from political parties, but no elected representatives. And that campaign I would hold today, it's not here, I'm not here to justify it or anything else, but I would hold it as has been one of the most effective community action campaigns in the British Isles. And I think the fact that the Shankill, I got a rather highly overblown introduction by Gareth. Thanks, Gareth. But it was definitely one of the most, I believe, successful community action campaigns. And I don't believe there would be a Shankill there today at all if it wasn't for the Save the Shankill campaign, because I think there were other things at play, which is another day's discussion. So what I wanted to say was that the UWC strike was an end in some ways, but was in a beginning in another. In terms of redevelopment, in terms of the Save the Shankill campaign, we learned directly lessons from it and drew directly, consciously, from its strength without apology. And by the way, still without apology. But more than that, I also think that the arrangements we have today, and I wouldn't be so much like Glenn as to write them off, the arrangements that we have today. I think they're politically desperately flawed, but nevertheless I wouldn't foolhardily write them off. But I believe the politics that came to the surface then, whereby people in paramilitary organisations knew that there was more to fighting the war than simply a physical fight against the IRA, and had seen that their actions on the street, combined with other people's and in coalition with other people's, could have an effect. I believe that resonates right through today, and I believe it led to the origins and the outworkings of political parties, which maybe have never realised their full potential in terms of working class political parties, but it's a story that is still unfolding. But the one lesson that was learned out of the whole thing is that the UWC strike was able to stop something happening. It was able to stop the power sharing executive from happening and the implementation of the Sunningdale Agreement. The Save the Shankill campaign was able to stop something happen. It was able to stop the flats being built. It was able to stop those shops being knocked down. What we've never discovered from our community is how to make something happen. And that's the lesson that we're still learning. Thanks, Gareth.
Thanks, Jackie. Okay, Nell, would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, I'm away. I'm hoping to meet some lawyers, preferably you, since you seem a friendly fellow, by tomorrow. We're talking DNA here today. My granny's from the Shankill, Sarah McAleer. I must have cousins up the Shankill. They're not claiming me. I'd like to claim them. Perhaps we can meet and discuss it. They ran a Shebeen up on Agnes Street, which is a pub. My DNA is Bogside Catholic Fenian, with that wee bit of Protestant Shankill blood. I'm not going to rewrite history. I'm not going to speak now with hindsight. I'm just going to read about what it was like then during the Ulster Workers' Council strike. I know we went into that strike, or at least I did, and people I knew went into it in Derry, backing the strike. They were quite right. Let's bring down the Sunningdale arrangement, because it's going to fling us all into United Ireland, and if we want to bring it down, have a general election. I went in there saying, stop Sunningdale. I came out of it, for reasons which might become obvious here, saying, God bless the Free State. And thank God we in Derry are near the Free State. I mean, three miles from my bogside home, right into the Free State, and what then became freedom and no more rations. I wrote this for the Irish Times. I was a journalist then, on the 26th of May, just before the strike ended, 1974. At the time, my outstanding memory is, I was in Derry at the time, I'd come up and done. My outstanding memory is, my mother made me take 3 baths a day while there was hot water, because the power was running out. The whole street was sick of being shoved in to have a bath, whether you wanted a bath or not. But towards the end of the strike, Harold Wilson, the British Prime Minister, is about to make a speech on radio to us all. He had flown in especially to London from his holiday home in the Scilly Isles, S-E-I-L-L-Y. And there we are waiting. At 9:55 on Saturday night, we gathered, my family, parents and children, we gathered in the living room to hear the speech. I was then, by the way, 30 years old. You see, said my mother, they'll switch off the electricity. At precisely 10:00, the electricity was cut off and the television fizzled into darkness. We lit the candles and switched on the radio and huddled to the fire. The radio announcer told us to stand by for a very important prime ministerial announcement at this grave time. You're right, said my mother. We sat dimly through news of the North and Nixon's Watergate crisis and the Syrian-Israeli situation and the weather forecasts. Towards 10:15, my mother got restless. She took a torch and went out to the kitchen and knelt on the floor and put a match to the little blue camping stove and placed the kettle on top of it. She stood up and looked out the scullery window. The dog, she observed, has not been doing so bad. He's had his tinned meat every day and his dog biscuits and his vitamin tablets and his half pint of milk. Whereas I'm standing here with a mouth on me like ship could get down for a cup of tea. Wilson came across the airwaves. She came in, my mother, and sat down. Wilson referred to the bank holiday weekend. That's right, said my mother. The factory girls are taking their holidays next week because of the power failure. The law was being set aside, continued Wilson, and essential services were being disrupted. I know that, said my mother. It was our duty, continued Wilson, to ensure that minorities were contented and that those in greatest need were helped. Aye, said my mother, your father's pension didn't get through the post office last week and we're going broke. In the years before 1970, Wilson droned on. Will you hurry up, said my mother, to the kettle. And then agreement was reached by the Northern Ireland executive, said Wilson, on hurriedly. Sure, we know that, said my mother. Has he given us a history lesson or what? We stand by, Wilson was saying, as our predecessor stood by and still stand by. Will you stop standing and get moving, said my mother, watching the kettle. Wilson said, where unemployment was traditionally one of the greatest evils. Aye, said my mother, our Paddy still hasn't got a job. He finished training a month ago, but sure, what does it matter now? Nobody's working anymore. Wilson said, have seen their sons vilified, spat upon and murdered. Aye, bloody Sunday, said my mother. Spend their lives sponging on Westminster and British democracy, thundered Wilson. What, said my mother, sitting up. Spongers? Is he calling us spongers? In the name of God and the sacred mother, is he telling us we're spongers? She made for the radio, we deflected her to the kettle. The patience of citizens, said Wilson, parents, taxpayers was becoming strained. My mother said, is he going to do anything? What's he going to do? What is he all sitting here, us all sitting here for? Does he think we're in school? Tonight, said Wilson, he was speaking for an extension of that patience for as long as it was needed. And that was the end of the Prime Minister's broadcast, the announcer was saying. What do you mean, the end, my mother asked him. Does he think we're Regents or what? What was that all about? And now the announcer said gravely, Brian Faulkner. In the name of God, said my mother, what is happening? Was I waiting all day for that? What about the gas? What about the electric light? Your sister has to go through the barricades to get to work on Monday, and the man from DuPont gets stoned coming back every day last week. They finished the midnight shift and couldn't leave till 6 in the morning for the beatings up they got in the ditches outside. Faulkner intruded on her speech. Will you shut up, she said to him. You've a face like a rat caught in a trap, if I could see it, which I can't because of no electric. Annie came in the door. Well, she asked. Well, she continued, standing in the candlelight, fishing up her sleeve for her cigarettes. Wilson, said my mother. Wilson is a yellow-bellied weed. He's a yellow-bellied weed. That's what he is, a yellow-bellied weed. But what was that all that about? Asked Annie, astonished. A history lesson, Annie, said my mother. Hang on there till you get a cup of tea. A history lesson, that's what we got. Me that's been dying for a potato and butter since Thursday, and the dog eating like a king, and we get a history lesson, and Wilson away on his holidays. Annie, what are you doing for the dinner tomorrow? She finished getting back to practicalities. Oh, I'll light a fire in the yard again, said Annie, if God spares us and it doesn't rain. Faulkner was talking. They weren't listening. It's worse down the high flats, said Annie. They need gas for the central heating as well, and they've no coal fires to boil a kettle on, and no yard for a barbecue, and the electric light doesn't come on till midnight when you're well past your dinner hour. Jackie up the street says we'll be going round in loincloths, like Adam and Eve. Will you explain to me, Annie, asked my mother. What was that all about? I couldn't, said Danny. Faulkner still talking in the background. Would you shut your beak, said my mother. You that put 1,000 men in internment camps with the stroke of a pen. Where's your pen now, foxy face? She took her torch and went out to the street and shone it up and down. Somebody asked her if she would phone Letterkenny across the Republic and ask them to bring in a camping stove. And that's another thing, said my mother, coming back in. The soldiers have pulled out of the camp at the top of the street and they took their solitary policeman with them. Will you explain to me what's going on? Faulkner had finished speaking. We switched off the radio and sat in the candlelight and watched the fire and wondered what Wilson had meant, why he was calling us spongers and why the British Army had pulled out of the bog side. A few days later, the strike ended. A few months later, come the Shankill Butchers. Goodbye to my Protestant granny. I'm not going looking for her up there. We had come into this out of Bloody Sunday. I know John Kim says she needed Ireland now or never. Look, we don't have to rehearse that, but then we done did out of Bloody Sunday. But when the strike came, and the Sunningdale Agreement, we're sitting there saying Sunningdale, the Free State's going to come and sit in the government. Look, I'm a product of the British state. I got my education free. I got a grant that was to Queen's that was equal to half my father's wages after tax. My father's sitting there after heart attacks, slightly paralysed, but his health system is very good. We don't want to give that up. Derry is kind of uniquely situated on the western half where I live. It's all Catholic as far as the eye can see, which is right to the hills of Donegal, 2 miles away. You have to cross over the bridge to get to the other side where Glenbar and the Protestants and the Unionists live. Well, we used to be mixed, skip over that. You crossed over the water side to get to the British side. If we'd ever blown up that bridge, we were in the Free State, separated from the North. Oh, yous would have missed Derry. I can tell you. If he ever tried to blow up that bridge, would have been hijacked by us first. You're not going near that bridge. We used to joke among ourselves the day they decided to cut Derry off, who among us will be first over that bridge? Eamon McCann was slightly faster. We're not giving it up. We are staying in the North. We just want a few British rights while we're here. Like, we'd like a few of the jobs, which we then realised the Unionists had. They can switch on the electricity. They controlled everything. They're also allowed to patrol the roads with all your cudgels and your hidden guns or whatever. And the British Army does nothing about you. Yes, we knew where the power lay. We also knew when it ended where the salvation lay. Derry, my side of Derry. We could walk all the way to Letterkenny. Glenbar isn't going to stop me either. I know Glenn was handsome killing Derry. I used to say to him, God, men are easy pleased. He was well handsome. We were safe. All we got to do is go to the Free State, the way we did during World War II. You know, the Free State and got your butter, your eggs, you get everything. So we always had that behind us. We always had the river to keep us slightly safe from Northern Ireland. So yeah, we wanted British rights within that. A year later, the Shankill Butchers, I have changed my mind. I'm not coming to Belfast. I was frightened. And I'm living in Derry, but sometimes I drive from Dublin. A year later, I think, I need a bit of protection here. I'm not saying where I am now. I went in there thinking, quite right, break that Sunningdale Agreement foisted in the Free State and us and not even having a vote on it. I come out of it saying, God bless the Free State, and I stand between the two words. And later you can tell, might help me find my granny as well. Some of you are my cousins. Thank you.